You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, it's a common idea that our cats or dogs age 7 years for every human year. But where does that idea come from, and is it true? We'll find out from a veterinarian. First, between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews on wisconsinvote.org. Today we talk to Brian Stile. He's an attorney and UW Regent. He's a Republican running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, which includes Janesville. We spoke with him earlier today. Brian Stile, thanks for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, first take a half a minute or so to pitch yourself to voters in the 1st Congressional District. Why are you running?
Look, I'm running because I think Washington needs problem solvers. They need people to address problems head on, have open, honest conversations about how to solve those problems. And having 9 years working in manufacturing, private sector experience, never run for elected office before, I think those are the skill sets that we need to see in Washington to start getting work done on behalf of the voters here in Southeast Wisconsin.
Can you talk a little more about how your background, both in business and with the UW Regents, sets you up to represent the people there?
Yeah. Great question. So in manufacturing, every day you're solving problems. You're bringing product in the door, you're manufacturing it, you're getting it out of the door. You got to do those things on time. You got to do it under budget every time or you're fired. And if we had that type of private sector discipline process approach in Washington, I think we'd be in a much better place. Then I looked to the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents. And we take everything that we did on the board. I'm proud that we've held the line on tuition. And in Wisconsin, when you say you hold the line on spending, it's dollar for dollar holding the line. In Washington, they often mean 5%, 6%, 7% increases when they say they hold the line on spending. And so I think we need to take a Wisconsin-style approach of spending, demonstrated on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, to Washington, and we'd be in a much better place. And so I look and think my manufacturing private sector experience coupled with the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents and the education policies that we've pushed through prepare me well to represent the people of Southeast Wisconsin if given the opportunity.
Now, if you're ultimately elected, you would be replacing Representative Paul Ryan, House Speaker Paul Ryan. Can you look back at his nearly 20 years representing the district? How do you evaluate his time in office?
I look at his 20 years and think about all the big, bold conservative reforms he's pushed. And then some of those that have turned into really positive policies. I look at the tax reform that was passed recently. Probably one of the key pieces of legislation that he pushed for a number of years. And I think we're beginning to see the positive economic benefits of moving that type of tax legislation through. I think those ideas have a direct correlation into the economic growth that we're seeing. We're having individuals invest in creating jobs, expanding businesses, and that economic growth here is a real key first step. And then we need to continue those policies to continue the economic growth that we're seeing here in Wisconsin.
Are there needs in the 1st District in particular that you think need more advocacy in Washington?
I think in particular, I look at the budget process and kind of the spending that is coming out of Washington and get frustrated. And so in a private sector setting, in a manufacturing setting, when you have a bad product, that means you have a bad process. And I look at a lot of what's going on in Washington right now, and I see a bad product, and it's the result of a bad process. And so what we need to do is go in and make some changes to get better results. Maybe I can give you two quick examples.
Yeah.
And so in Wisconsin, we budget every 2 years. That means, you know, sometimes that's late. There's fights about what the priorities are. That's okay. But ultimately, that gets resolved. And then you have 23 months before you come back to the next spending cycle. In Washington, they budget every year. They're often 6 months late. And then they fight for the next 6 months, and then they're 6 months late. And what you end up with is a nonstop spending factory in Washington. If we took a Wisconsin-style approach, budget every 2 years, it would give time for a much more thoughtful, deliberative process as to how we're spending taxpayers' money, and ultimately would spend that money much more wisely, and I think would be able to reduce the total amount of spending. And so I think there's some process-driven opportunities to produce a better product for the voters here in Southeast Wisconsin.
Talking to Brian Stile about his campaign for Congress. He's running as a Republican in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Let's get into a couple issues that have been on the table in Congress, one that's been there for a long time, immigration, looking at legal, illegal, and some of the gray areas right now. What would be some of your priorities when it comes to immigration?
The immigration system as it currently set up is almost a complete disaster. Republicans and Democrats alike have let us down. And so what we need to do is we need a comprehensive immigration reform. And step one of that is securing the borders so that we don't return to the situation that we're in right now. And so step one, we need to secure the border. Step two, we need comprehensive immigration reform that addresses the complete disaster that we have on our hands.
How do you get there, though? The problem has been trying to do those piecemeal or all at once, and nobody seems to agree. As you were saying earlier, no one's really on board with the same process to get to those results.
Right. So there's a real problem of getting people to focus on what the key problem is and then address the problem. And so I think what we need to do is step one, secure the border. So that way you don't repeat the problem that we've created in the past. Step two, then, is to bring everybody to the table and have an open, honest conversation about what we need to do to resolve this problem going forward. And a key step of that is to create a legal immigration system that addresses our workforce needs. And so step one, we need to secure the border. And then step two, bring all those parties to the table and reach a comprehensive immigration reform so we have a logical and thoughtful legal immigration system.
One area where some elected Wisconsin Republicans are disagreeing with the Republican president is tariffs, the current tariffs on things like aluminum and steel, back and forth with American allies and economic competitors. What's your view on the latest on tariffs?
So what we need to do is have our allies have free, fair, reciprocal trade with the United States. If given the opportunity, Wisconsin workers will win the day every day. And so we have countries that are allies like Canada with a convoluted milk pricing scheme that makes it very difficult for our dairy farmers to be able to export our dairy products to Canada. We have countries that aren't our allies like China that have even more restraints and restrictions on American products being sold abroad. And so what we need to do is to push for free, fair, reciprocal trade. Tariffs ultimately are a tax, and they distort free market principles. And so what we need to do is reduce total tariffs and push for free, fair, reciprocal trade.
What do you think of President Trump's current tariffs, maybe as a negotiating tactic to bring down things like the Canadian barrier?
Yeah, it's a negotiating tactic. You kind of know where the president is on what chapter he is on the art of the deal. And so my hope is that we reach resolution quickly. I think we're starting to see that in some of the shift in language from the EU. On people coming back to the table. What I would like to do is move as quickly as we can to the resolution chapter of the Art of the Deal, where we get free, fair, reciprocal trade and drive down these barriers from our allies and from our non-allies so that American workers and Wisconsin workers can ship products around the globe freely and fairly.
Another big issue in elections this year, health care, the Affordable Care Act, efforts to repeal it. What would you want to do as a member of Congress?
What we need to do is stay focused on reducing the cost of healthcare and improving the quality. And you, in my opinion, you don't do that through a government takeover of healthcare. You do that through putting the power in the individual and the patient and the doctor to make choices. The more that individuals and patients control their destiny and their power, the more we're going to be able to reduce the cost of healthcare and improve the quality of healthcare.
A lot of people look at the situation and say, well, it's not a choice between government controlling versus individuals and doctors. It's government bureaucracy versus insurance company bureaucracy. Are there solutions that you see in the insurance field that could give more power to patients?
Sure. So that's a great question. And I think that's a false choice that's often presented to individuals, that the choice is between big government and big insurance. The third option that is what we need to drive towards is patients and doctor-centered approaches. And so you look at some of these HSA programs. I look at myself. When I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, I had a high deductible plan. It was the first time ever that I was in control of my own destiny as I was making decisions that were in the best interest of myself. I'll give you an example. I was a young, healthy guy, so I'll use an example of when I chose my dentist. For the first time ever, I called around to all the dentists and said, what would it cost if I paid out of pocket for a teeth cleaning and an x-ray? And my lifelong dentist was not able to give me an answer on that. And I found another dentist. It was a balance of quality and cost. And I ultimately chose that dentist, continue using him to this day. But giving individuals and giving doctors the choice as to how to allocate their funds, that's a key step in driving cost down and quality up. Now, I want to be clear, that's not in every instance that there's going to be a cost-benefit analysis. You're in a car accident, you're in you know, have some sort of serious issue, that's a different ballgame. But where we have opportunities to allow patients and doctors to make the decisions that are in their best interest, the more we're going to be able to drive costs down and quality up.
Any other issues that we haven't talked about that are particular focus areas for you?
One area that I've spent a lot of time on while working on the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents is how do we prepare our workers for the jobs of the future? And so often the federal government gets in the way and puts up roadblocks as we look to make efficiency reforms at the University of Wisconsin level and across the education system across the board. So I think there's a real opportunity in Washington to take my area of expertise in the education side and to remove those impediments from Washington, empowering local individuals, local school boards, the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, to make decisions that are in the best interest of Wisconsin students and Wisconsin taxpayers. And so I often think that decision-making and those dollars are better in the pockets of a student than they are in the pockets of a Washington, D.C. bureaucrat. And so I'd like to push those reforms such that we move the power structure from Washington back to Wisconsin, to our local school boards and decision makers.
We'll leave it there for now. Brian Stile, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Brian Stile is an attorney and UW Regent. He's running as a Republican for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican incumbent in the race for Wisconsin's 5th District, joins us at this time tomorrow. Between now and the August 14th primary, candidates who are running in contested primaries have the opportunity to join us for interviews on Central Time and the morning show. You can find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Sometimes we love our pets so much that we want them to be truly part of the family, and one way some people do that is to celebrate a pet's birthday. But it's not enough to know how many years they've been alive. We also want to know how long that feels in human years. Probably heard someone talk about 1 year for a dog or cat is like 7 human years, but where does that come from and how accurate is it? Dr. Jesse Grady is a small animal veterinarian and clinical instructor of veterinary medicine at Mississippi State University. Dr. Grady, thanks for joining us.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Well, do you hear this a lot of times from your human clients? How old is my pet in, you know, human versus dog years?
Sure. It's a very common question, and it's a good one to have. You know, we often do this to our pets for multiple reasons. Like you said, we celebrate my cat's birthday every year with a can of food and a lit candle in it, but also we want to know how old they are so we can kind of compare them to ourselves. You know, how much more time do I potentially have with this pet that I love, you know, almost as much and sometimes more than certain people?
And a lot of people have that years times 7. So a 5-year-old dog is equal to a 35-year-old human. You've written about this. That's not quite right, is it?
No, but like most myths in society, it has a little nugget of truth to it. So probably where this started out is that for an average or medium-sized dog, so a 20 to 50-pound dog, once they reach the adulthood stage, so basically once they reach the stage that they are sexually and bone mature, no longer growing, they actually probably fit that little niche of 7 years to 1 dog year. Problem is that we now have multiple different types of breeds of dog, ranging from little bitty Chihuahuas to Great Danes and Irish Wolfhounds. And the time that it takes them to reach that adult stage can vary a little bit, too. So that's probably how this started, was that your average-sized dog as an adult is almost fitting that 7-year rule. But we've got lots of different dogs now, so we choose a different way to gauge this measurement nowadays.
And for a lot of people, this is just a matter of curiosity. But for you as a veterinarian, you write that it is useful to maybe not have that exact number, but know what years correspond to different stages of a dog or a cat's life. So how does that work in practice?
Yeah, so, you know, many people want to know the year type thing, and we can come up with a number if it's necessary, you know, especially if it's, you know, something that people want to really know. But what we really want to know as a veterinarian is what life stage an animal is in, both a dog and a cat. so that for each of those life stages, we can then recommend health care that is best for the stage that they're in. These stages were formulated and agreed upon by large groups of veterinarians and published, and it's updated periodically, through a group called the American Animal Hospital Association. For dogs and cats, we actually have six life stages, and we do different things for the animals to prevent disease during these life stages. The easiest comparison would be that a human toddler doesn't need a colonoscopy, but at a certain age, that toddler, once they're an adult, possibly over 55 or so, is going to need, or their doctor is going to recommend that they have a colonoscopy. So we do similar things in animals as well, so that we can say that your kitten needs this, but your senior cat needs these different things at this time.
And you mentioned different sizes of dogs, in a sense, aging at different rates. Do you take that into effect, the size, say, of a dog when you're figuring out which stage of life it's in?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of the size of the dog as well as its breed. So we group the dogs in kind of size categories of small dog, medium dog, large dog, and giant breed dog. All these animals are, for the first two stages of life, puppy and junior, are going to age at relatively the same rate, with the larger breed and the giant breed dogs lagging a little bit behind. And then once we reach adulthood, the large and giant breed dogs are going to age a little bit faster than the small and medium dogs. With dogs and cats, though, and same in humans, these are for a average healthy animal of that size range. There are lots of variables that can influence, your life expectancy, just like a person, including obesity, nutrition, and general preventive health care.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Grady, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Jesse Grady is a small animal veterinarian and clinical instructor of veterinary medicine at Mississippi State University. He wrote a piece for The Conversation called How Old Is My Pet in Dog Years or Cat Years? A Veterinarian Explains. We've gotten one cat picture, by the way, on International Cat Day. You can keep emailing them to ideas@WPR.org. Now, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today, we continue our interviews with candidates for governor. There's a contested primary for both Republicans and Democrats. Today, we talked to Paul Soglin. He's currently the mayor of Madison and has held that post for over two decades at three different times. He's running for governor of Wisconsin as a Democrat. Mayor Soglin had hoped to join us live, but because of a Democratic candidate debate tonight, we spoke with him earlier today. Mayor Soglin, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, give us the elevator pitch, the length of an elevator ride to tell people why you're running for governor of Wisconsin.
Well, we just simply have to fix the state, and we've got so many opportunities. There's so many things we can do in terms of improving our public schools, the transportation systems, whether we're talking roads in rural areas or public transit in the major cities of the state. Healthcare. It's not just a question of the foolishness of the Walker administration in rejecting Medicaid payments and rejecting participation in the marketplace, but there are things we can do to keep the quality up and yet get the cost down. We had a system here in Madison involving a clinic. People from eight counties surrounding Dane came there. We had quality health care. We could do that in every region of the state. And, you look at the other areas, horrible policies by the Walker administration in terms of what's happening to dairy farmers, the opportunities in terms of the environment. There is just so much on the agenda that can have wonderful results, make us a great state, and we're missing opportunities as the clock ticks away.
Can you talk about your background as mayor of Madison for many years and how that would prepare you for the job of governor?
Well, if you look at my career, on both the public and the private side, It's really unmatched. I've had 25 years in the private sector, including owning my own businesses, working for major corporations in the state, and at the same time, 22 years as mayor of the city. That combination of experiences, I know how to lead, and while a lot of politicians can talk, they can describe the problem, they can even describe the solutions. Getting to implementation and making a difference, whether it was what I did with the Madison Transit System, all the new construction here in town, which is opening up the housing market, we've got to have a governor who can get things done.
Now, as you know, people from around the state look at Madison with some suspicion. At best, they might think, well, it's different. It doesn't apply to our needs out here. At worst, there's a rivalry, kind of. How would you make the case to people outside of Madison that you can serve them?
The case is made very simply by how it's done. To create a great place, to create a great community, the objective is not to have an economic policy that focuses on corporate giveaways. And that's the great error and tragedy of the Walker administration. The way you do it, the way we did it in Madison, and it's applicable all over the state, is focusing on five areas. Affordable housing. Housing comes first. Kids who are homeless do not learn in school. Families that are spending 40%, 50% of their household income are not going to be financially viable in terms of affording everything from food to clothing. Housing is first. Transportation, access to schools, to jobs is critical. Quality child care is essential. Then comes health care, which we've talked about. And lastly, the greatest thing for a community is its public school system. You focus on those five, you then have the kind of place where the private sector wants to invest, where businesses will locate, and everybody is really healthy in terms of the community.
We're talking to Madison Mayor Paul Soglin about his campaign for governor in the Democratic primary. Let's turn, you mentioned corporate incentives from the government. Let's talk about the Foxconn deal. As governor, how would you approach that?
Well, I am confident, based on all the manipulations and shenanigans that went on, that there are violations of state law and that there are violations of the contract. It's real simple, and I've been there. I've inherited three awful deals like this from my predecessors when I was mayor. It's real simple. You cut off the cash, you cut off the financial incentives, and you say to them, come back to the table, or you can sue us, but it is not going to continue. And I want to say, most importantly, that I've been involved in public-private partnerships, and there is an appropriate way of doing it. And we did it here recently in Madison with Exact Sciences, where they guaranteed a starting wage of $15 an hour, a pension, and health insurance. The Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City, they are the experts on entrepreneurship and capitalism. And it's almost as though the Walker administration read all of their research and findings and decided to violate every one of them, such as the notion that how you create great jobs, that is done by small, locally owned businesses. It is not done by giant corporations. So that's the first mistake. Second mistake, these major competitions where states are trying to outbid one another in the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, the state always loses. And, of course, these are the things that Walker did that don't have to be done, and our state can do so much better.
On a related note, there's been talk of some kind of comparable incentive package, not as large, for Kimberly Clark, trying to get them to keep at least some of their jobs here in Wisconsin. Stalling right now, it looks like. Would you pursue something like that?
That's just compounding the problem. And as I said at the time of Foxconn, it's not only a bad deal, but if Foxconn is done, it's going to set the bar for future horrible deals, and that's exactly what it did in Kimberly Clark. I find it interesting. They can't get enough votes at this time among Republicans in the legislature. Even some of the Republicans are beginning to realize how stupid this is. Kimberly Clark is no better. It could even be fashioned as worse than Foxconn.
Staying with jobs and the economy, Governor Walker has been running, will be running on Wisconsin's low unemployment rate. And it's low. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm glad he's proud of it. And good for him. That's what I have to say. But that's not what the people of the state want. They want jobs with viable incomes. They want jobs with plans for their retirement. They want jobs that show dignity and respect and have health insurance. You know, Walker's got this fascination about making everything record numbers. Quantity is one measurement as to how we're doing. The other is quality. And the quality is not there in the lives of Wisconsin residents, whether we're talking in the larger cities or in the smaller towns and communities. And that can be fixed with the appropriate economic strategies.
So what is that strategy? How do you create better paying jobs with those benefits you're talking about?
Well, I mentioned those five critical areas before. You've got to focus on those. And that, in effect, will build it, as they say, and it will come. The second thing that has to be done in this state, and this is the wisest investment that the state can make, is high-speed internet to serve every home, every business in the state of Wisconsin. Our school children need it. Our farmers need it. Our small businesses need it. Our large businesses need it. The state of Wisconsin can be wired for about $1.5 billion. And what we ought to do is take $500 million, $500 million of state money is our part of the investment, offer it up to the private sector, who's going to have to come up with $1 million, and have competitive bidding, and we can get this state wired just the way we did for electricity and landline telephones 100 years ago. And we know that when that came to Wisconsin, it helped everybody and improved our economy. We wouldn't think of not having electricity in a Wisconsin property today.
We're talking to Madison Mayor Paul Soglin about his campaign for governor in the Democratic primary. We spoke with him earlier today because of tonight's candidate debate in Madison. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Mayor Paul Soglin is with us. We're talking about his campaign in the Democratic primary for governor of Wisconsin. You mentioned education as part of the key to economic success in Wisconsin. Specifically, what kind of policies would you pursue for K through 12 education?
Well, the first thing is we've got to change the financing. We have to take that majority of the financing of public education in all of our communities off the property taxes. We can do that by a combination of an increase in the sales tax a half a cent and making our income tax more progressive, especially at the higher end. But I think it's critical that we remove so much of our burden on public schools from property tax. The second thing we need to do is we have to change the state funding formula. The funding formula was originally based on a combination of population and the value of real estate, as though that was a measure of poverty or wealth in a community. We should have a new formula, and that is based on population and households' income. Household income, not property values, with the state picking up a significant part of that cost, and really making a commitment to getting quality education, paying teachers what they deserve, and getting parents involved in the education of their kids.
I want to ask a process question. I've heard people say we need to change the education formula in Wisconsin for decades now. I think it's fair to say, how do you get that started? It's a hornet's nest. There's a lot of stakeholders. How do you make that happen as governor?
Well, the way to start it is you have a hold harmless position. And that means that those communities that would lose money under the new formula will be guaranteed, they will be held harmless, that their funding will not be reduced under the new formula. Then you kick in the formula. But it's just outrageous that wealthy suburban districts should get as much, if not more, than poor communities throughout the state of Wisconsin. Somebody has to have the courage. Somebody has to have the confidence. Somebody has to have the experience to go in there and fix it. And that's what I'm going to do.
And how about the state's voucher school program?
Well, unfortunately, we were told two things about vouchers and charter schools years ago, neither of which have come true. And all it's done is hurt our public schools. The first we were told is that charters and private schools would perform better than our public schools. And while there may be anecdotes about some specific schools, overall across the board, they have not performed better. In a lot of cases, they've performed worse. Second thing we were told was that by having vouchers, this would create competition for our public schools, forcing them to improve. And that has not happened. In fact, what has happened is the money that's been sucked out of our public schools has only made it more difficult for them. Now, I would not pull any kid out of a school they're going to today. So I would allow any child to be continued on the program until they were until they graduated from that institution. But that would be the end.
With continued state support, if it was some using a voucher?
With continued state support with the vouchers, but no new kids enrolled. And obviously, over a period of time, those resources would be available for Wisconsin public schools. There is nothing anyone can do to strengthen any community in this state, rural, urban, or suburban, that is as important as the quality of the public schools. That is what drives everything. You want to have people highly trained who are educated to work for your company? You'd better have a great public school system for them. You want your grandchildren raised in your community? Well, your kids are not staying, and we've seen this throughout the state, unless there are great jobs and great public schools for those grandchildren to attend. We can fix that.
Act 10, which limited collective bargaining for teachers and a lot of other public employees, what would you do? Would you try to repeal it, change it, what?
What I would do is I would enact laws here in the state of Wisconsin that would restore collective bargaining and restore unions. My experience over the years, and you can look at the quality of life in Madison, public and private unions have not been detrimental to the overall quality of work within the state and have made for a better place. And I want to just point out that when we talk about prevailing wage, a lot of the contractors wish prevailing wage was back in the state. And for those who don't know what it is in effect requiring on our public contracts that certain minimum wages be paid for the building trades. And the reason is, those contractors are proud of the work they do. They want the most skilled labor possible, and they cannot be competitive bidders without recognition of prevailing wage so they can produce the quality work Wisconsin is used to.
Madison Mayor Paul Soglin is with us talking about his campaign for governor. He's running in the Democratic primary. Let's talk about rural Wisconsin a little bit. A lot of challenges.
Yes.
Declining population in many communities, schools, as you alluded to, facing declining enrollment, problems in agriculture, small farms. What would be your agricultural and rural policy?
Well, a couple of things. First, Wisconsin has one of the greatest exodus of 20 and 30-year-olds in the United States, and that's principally almost every single county in the state of Wisconsin is losing in proportion its 20 and 30-year-olds. You can just see that from the census data. Why are they leaving? I said it before, the quality of the schools and the availability of jobs. Well, whether we're talking about a town of 500 or a community of 2,000, most of Wisconsin is dependent on the health of agriculture and the dairy industry. Well, Scott Walker basically destroyed the dairy industry in Wisconsin. He's got this fetish about setting records. He doesn't care, as we discussed on the job numbers before, about quality. He just wants numbers. So he wanted to set records, which we did, for milk production. And he gave these financial incentives, and some farms took them up, and we set milk production records. And guess what, folks? The bottom fell out of the market. With this great surplus of available milk, prices plummeted, and perfectly innocent dairy farmers, family farmers here in the state, went bankrupt. We had a record number of dairy bankruptcies in the western half of the state. Well, I think the state is going to have to repair this Walker disaster. We're going to have to take steps to help these farmers recover. One of the things we can do, which is separate from that, but addresses the problem, is get control of the CAFOs. The CAFOs are a disaster on so many different levels. First of all, they obviously, with their really deep pockets, their out-of-state money, they are capable of undermining our local family farmers. Secondly, with the exemptions they have and the horrible standards, they are ruining our streams, our rivers, and even our drinking water, as they are not using proper techniques to deal with the manure and all the runoff that comes with it. I would reinstitute state minimum standards in regards to the size of these farms, the requirements in terms of health and safety and the environment, and I would allow each county, if it so choose, to have local control, and they could set higher standards. Next thing I'd do is we got to do something about the roads. Transportation and the road situation in most of Wisconsin is just a disaster. The irony is, of course, our great road system was originally built to get fresh milk to market, and as we've known, it's also helped the tourism industry and the rest of manufacturing in the state. So we've got to index and raise the gas tax. Use that money. We are spending too much of our transportation dollars on interest payments, when if we were to increase the gas tax and start paying cash, we could do a much better job in improving the roads and dealing with the state's financial stability.
We'll leave it there for now. Mayor Soglin, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Madison Mayor Paul Soglin is running for governor as a Democrat. Mayor Soglin had hoped to join us live because of a Democratic candidate's debate tonight. We talked to him earlier today.